The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Today we are going to get a crash course, lots of background information on the Federal Real ID Act and its implications for Minnesota for us to contemplate. I'm very pleased and very honored that we have somebody all the way from Colorado. Jeremy, are you from Colorado or are you in D.C.?
Washington.
Washington. He is a policy analyst and staff to the National Conference of State Legislators who has been working very, very hard on this issue. He's going to give us a briefing on where we're at nationally and also give us kind of a crash course on what the Real ID Act is about. And then we're going to have our own Ms. Katie Engler come and speak with us on the privacy implications in the Real ID Act for the state of Minnesota. We're going to hear from Ms. Pat McCormick from the Department our Vehicle Services about an update, because I know that the Transportation Committee has had a couple of hearings and updates. But we would like her input on where things are at from their perspective in terms of the hardware and the hookups. And then we have a citizen participant who called the committee when he heard that we were going to be having a hearing on the Real ID Act, who has been following this very closely, and he has asked to speak to the committee. I would encourage anybody else in the audience, if you are here today, you would like to comment, or if you would like to testify and be on the record, please send a note or contact Regina Garza so that we just have an idea of who's going to be participating. On that note, I want to thank the members for being here today, Senator Betzel and Senator Foley. Other members should be coming. Many of them are coming from a bit of a distance, so with that note, I want to say thank you again to both Senator Foley and Senator Betzel for being here. And without any other delay, Mr. Meadows, welcome to Minnesota and welcome to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to come and to speak to you about the Real ID. And I want to thank the Chair and the members of the committee for your interest in the issue and for inviting the National Conference of State Legislatures to testify on the Real ID Act. My name is Jeremy Meadows. I'm out of NCSL's Washington, D.C. office, and I work closely with Molly Ramsdell on the Real ID issues. This, of course, is something that has come up as a major concern for states all across the country as these federal regulations are still pending and states are contemplating how, if and how, to comply. My goal this morning is to provide just an overview of what the Real ID is, where we are in the process, perhaps a snapshot of what is happening in the other states relative to Real ID, and then I, of course, will be very happy to take any of your questions as the hearing progresses. I hope to talk about what the Real ID is, to talk a little bit about some of the challenges that the states are facing relative to time, money, and the verification systems. Then specifically relative to the verification systems, we'll look at connectivity concerns and privacy. I'd like to give you an update on what's happening in Congress relative to Real ID, in other state capitals, and then tell you what NCSL is doing on your behalf in Washington relative to Real ID. Real ID is a law that requires states to adopt new federal standards for driver's licenses and state-issued identification cards by May 11, 2008, or the federal government will not recognize a state's driver's license or ID for federal purposes, and those federal purposes include boarding a commercial aircraft, entering federal buildings, entering nuclear power plants, or any other purposes that the Secretary of Homeland Security may determine. And it's important to note that the consequences of not complying with Real ID don't necessarily fall on state government, but they fall on the constituents or the citizens or residents of that state. So this is an unusual or different tact on the part of the federal government for encouraging compliance by the states. What are some of these federal standards? States will be required to issue new driver's licenses or identification cards to all 245 million license holders by May 11, 2013. They will be required to electronically verify with the issuing agency the validity of all identification documents presented in order to obtain the new driver's license or identification card. They'll be required to provide electronic access to other states for information contained in those states' DMV databases. And they'll be required to conduct background checks on certain state DMV employees. All of these require access to databases or verification systems that we'll talk about a little bit later in the presentation. Other federal standards include ensuring the physical security of the locations where driver's licenses and identification cards are produced, the security of the document materials and papers from which the driver's license or ID cards are manufactured, retaining copies of all of the source documents that residents may present in order to request a driver's license. If a state chooses to comply with Real ID, they are then presented with the option of issuing a non-conforming driver's license or identification card for anyone who may not want a Real ID or for anyone who may not be eligible for a Real ID. So you're required to make that choice if you choose to comply. And then finally, states will be required to adopt prescriptive requirements for their driver's license and identification card design. Now on to some of the challenges. In particular, there's the challenge of time. The Department of Homeland Security released draft regulations in early March of this year, and the comment period closed on May 8th. And in the materials that I've brought with me and available on NCSL's website is a copy of NCSL's analyses of the draft regulations, as well as NCSL's comments to DHS on those draft regulations. We're currently 9 months to the deadline, and we're still waiting on final regulations from the Department of Homeland Security. Draft regulations, as currently written, would require the states to re-enroll all 245 million drivers by May 11th, 2013, and we don't think that this really constitutes a true extension because it moves the starting point for the re-enrollment process, but it doesn't move the end point. So in reality, we think it simply compresses the re-enrollment period, which in all accounts, I think, exacerbates the problem as opposed to alleviating the problem for state DMVs. The extension that states can receive upon a request and pursuing a particular process with the Department of Homeland Security could be to December 31st of 2009. So without moving that 2013 deadline, you end up going from 5 to just a little over 3 years for the re-enrollment process, which is why we think this compression is a problem. Money is also a challenge. To date, only $40 million have been appropriated by Congress for state implementation. That $40 million was appropriated in fiscal year 2006. Nothing was requested in 2007. Nothing was requested by the president in 2008. DHS, in the draft regulations, or when they announced the draft regulations, stated that the several states could use up to 20% of their 2007 State Homeland Security Grant or SHISGAP program funds for implementation of the Real ID Act. It's important to note, and I'm sure you're all aware, that SHISGAP funds are largely spent on first responders, that states have to pass through 80% of their state grants to localities, and that in most cases, if not all cases, these funds are already accounted for, obligated, or have expected uses, and Real ID was not on the list. As far as fiscal year 2008 appropriations are concerned, $50 million is currently in the House Department of Homeland Security Appropriations Bill. There is zero funding in the Senate Appropriations Bill. There was an effort to add $300 million to the Senate Appropriations Bill by Tennessee Senator Lamar Alexander, but that effort failed on the Senate floor. I want to note that the National Conference of State Legislatures, the National Governors Association, and the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators have all been cooperating in Washington on the Real ID effort, and in September of last year conducted a fairly thorough analysis of the policy and fiscal impact of Real ID on the states. And our conservative estimate was that Real ID will cost the states $11 billion over 5 years. We estimate that to be $1 billion in startup costs and $10 billion in ongoing costs. And again, we figure that that's very conservative and an at least number. DHS, when they released the draft regulations, estimated $23.1 billion over a 10-year period. And there, included in that $23.1 billion was $10 to $14 billion of state costs. DHS also tried to estimate and incorporate in their cost analysis opportunity cost, if you will, cost to the residents for standing in line, for going to the DMV, having to present individually and personally to the DMV in order to get a driver's license, since online renewal or through the mail renewal will now be obsolete. So we're talking about very big numbers, billion with a B, and at this point in time, really, Washington is only allocating about or discussing the allocation of $90 million.
Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, are you going to take questions now, or do you want to wait till the end of the presentation?
Members, if you feel that there's a certain point you'd like to ask some questions, please feel free to do so. Senator Foley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. What we're looking at is obviously a serious concern. Talking about validation, who is going to validate these? Where are they going to get the documents to validate them and so forth?
Mr. Meadows.
And more importantly, I guess, because you're talking about money, what who's going to pay for all of that?
Mr. Meadows.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Foley, it's an excellent question. I will come to some of the validation and verification questions in a moment. But relative to the money, DHS, as they issued the draft regulations, made it fairly clear that they expected the states would recuperate their cost by passing the cost on to cardholders. Now, some states have estimated that that could be as much as a $100 to $125 increase in the cost of a driver's license per driver. So that's fairly significant. I know Maryland, for example, I heard one legislator at our annual meeting in Boston last week note that currently her driver's license costs something like $40 a year and would, if Real ID came into effect in Maryland, would end up being $160 a year, or upon issuance. So there are, in many ways, it's up to the states at this point in time how it would be paid for if the state chooses to comply, because the Congress has not appropriated the funds to compensate.
Thank you.
Please continue, Mr. Meadows.
Thank you. Of the $40 million that has been appropriated by Congress in fiscal year 2006, I want to tell you a little bit about how that money has been spent so far. When that appropriation passed Congress, there were $6 million set aside for pilot projects in two states. Those two states were Kentucky and New Hampshire. Kentucky is continuing with its pilot project, but New Hampshire has declined to proceed with its pilot project and has returned the funding to DHS, who has, according to a plan that they just recently issued, has reallocated that $3 million. Which is part of the reason that the numbers under the $34 million on the screen don't add up to $34 million, because that $3 million from New Hampshire has been reallocated. $4 million of the $34 million has been distributed to Kentucky for redistribution to all of the states in order to assist with connectivity to the EVE system, and I'll come to the EVE system in a moment. All states can request up to $75,000 from Kentucky in order to connect to and participate in the EVE system or to assist in connectivity there too. $31.3 million will be a competitive grant process that states will need to apply to DHS in order to receive those funds. Now, how can the grants be used? There are nine possible ways that are currently being advertised, but here are five of the key. Enhancements to a communications hub to support federated querying of verification databases and state-to-state data exchanges. States could use grant funds for initial development of a secure indexing or pointer system for state-to-state data exchanges. States could develop a federated querying system for verification of lawful presence. States could improve, initiate improvements to the EVE hub in order to support the volume of transactions that are expected under RealID. Or states could spend their grant funds on model standards and procedures for document verification and authentication by state DMVs. Most of these verification systems, this relates to connectivity or software, not necessarily hardware. So, you know, these funds could not necessarily be used to buy new computers or printers that might be associated with RealID, but it's related to connectivity between the states or between the verification systems. Now looking at the verification systems.
Mr. Meadows?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm curious, why Kentucky and New Hampshire? And then why did New Hampshire return the money?
I don't recall exactly why Kentucky and New Hampshire were carved out to begin with. I know that the Department of Homeland Security looks to Kentucky as perhaps being, in terms of the systems, being one of the more quote-unquote advanced states for compliance with RealID. New Hampshire, I'm not entirely sure, other than perhaps they anticipated difficulties with New Hampshire compliance, and Congress was looking to perhaps sweeten the deal. But I don't know precisely why, so both of those are speculation on my part. But New Hampshire did opt not to comply or not to use those funds, and so they were returned to DHS for redistribution.
And then, Ms. Meadows, in terms of the grants, has a timeline or a timetable been released with respect to the two grant processes?
Kentucky is in the process of initiating the redistribution of the EVE connectivity funds or the grants to all of the states. There is a grant process in place for the balance, the $30 or $31.3 million. DHS just recently, in late June, I believe, filed their plan with Congress on how they were going to use these funds or distribute the funds, which was the trigger necessary for unlocking those funds. I don't know if there is a particular RFP process or the deadlines, but I can certainly find out.
Thank you.
Looking at the verification systems, the Act requires states to verify with the issuing agency the issuance, validity, and completeness of each document required to be presented by the person applying for a driver's license or an identification card. Applicants must provide proof of identity, documentation showing date of birth, evidence of a Social Security number, or proof of ineligibility for a Social Security number, documentation of address of principal residence, and evidence of lawful status in the U.S. In particular, applicants must provide as proof of identity a valid, unexpired U.S. passport, a certified copy of a birth certificate, a consular report of birth abroad, an unexpired permanent resident card, an unexpired employment authorization document, an unexpired foreign passport with a valid U.S. visa, U.S. certificate of citizenship, U.S. certificate of naturalization, or a real ID compliant license or identification card from that state or another state. DHS did consider other documents that could be presented and rejected a couple of those. That includes the Transportation Worker Identification Credential and the Department of Defense Common Access Card. Now, I want to note that U.S. passports are held, currently at least, and there's a massive backlog at the passport agency, but that only 25% of Americans hold passports at this time. TWIC, the Transportation Worker Identification Credential, is not being accepted because it would require DHS to develop and for the DMVs to access information electronically using a system that has yet to be created. And the Department of Defense Common Access Card is not being used because it would require states to connect to additional federal databases for verification purposes without sufficient justification. So those are a couple of the challenges that face the credentials that DHS has currently discussed for verification of who a person is, verification of identity.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Mr. Meadows, is there any federal standard that will be the target and that people will comply as so far as these various issues? It seems to me that if you're using any of those documents that you measured as a baseline, you've got all kinds of documents that people have that are checking those, the driver license and so forth, that may or may not have the skills to deal with that. Is any part of this deal with training and staffing of the people that will be doing the checking?
Ms. Meadows.
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Foley, that's an excellent question. That is one of the challenges that's facing all of the states as they contemplate compliance. At this point in time, there is some discussion within DHS of the kinds of training that state DMV officials might need, but in terms of the cost of that training and the how that training would be carried out, at this point it's really left up to the states and or the states cooperating voluntarily with DHS. There is not a funding stream that would support that kind of training for state officials. And you're correct that there's a number of documents. It's just you can see the whole list of documents that could be eligible. And if you consider that the birth certificates are issued by some 13,000 or more agencies across the nation, there's a wide number of documents and issuing agencies that DMV officials will need to be aware of or consult with in order to verify those documents. That's one of the major challenges. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Meadows, has there been any discussion on what the treatment of tribal ID cards will be?
The treatment of what ID cards?
Tribal ID cards.
That is it's another major concern. DHS is looking at that. That's one of the issues that has been raised, both by NCSL, but also with American Indian Associations in Washington. And they're looking at how they may or may not comply with DHS draft regulations and what kind of standing they would have for this verification process. So the decisions are pending.
I mean, I would think that there would be some sovereignty issues.
There are.
But obviously DHS is not at this point willing to say if you have a tribal ID card, that would be the same as perhaps a an unexpired foreign passport or something like that. Interesting.
That's correct.
Wow. Thank you.
In terms of the verification systems, a few of the things that applicants will need to provide when they present in person at a DMV to obtain a driver's license or an identification card, they'll need to show documentation that proves the date of birth. And any of the documents that I noted before would be eligible for that. They need to demonstrate evidence of Social Security number or proof of ineligibility for a Social Security number. Ways they could present that would be a Social Security card, a W-2 form, and a series of SSA forms, or evidence that an individual is currently in a non-work but authorized non-immigrant status. They also need to present documentation of address of principal residence. Two documents of the state's choice must be verified in accordance with a system of document verification acceptable to DHS. So DHS has not provided any regulations or has yet to provide regulations on what that system should look like, but it'll need to be coordinated with DHS. And then evidence of lawful status in the U.S. And again, passport or any of the documents that I noted before. SSA, the Social Security Administration, has taken steps to strengthen the Social Security number issuance process. SSA has a plan for improving the security of the Social Security number card itself in compliance with the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004. DHS has considered requiring individuals to present a Social Security card as proof of either a Social Security card number or ineligibility therefor. However, in the draft regulations, DHS states, and I quote, "This approach would create an undue hardship on SSA and the public, particularly on members of the public who had lost or misplaced their Social Security cards." And I note that with some sense of irony because of the hardship that DHS is taking into consideration for SSA.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Mr. Meadow, on the issuance of those things and documents such as the Social Security card and so forth, really there's no security in that. That's a type of thing that individuals can easily counterfeit. And in addition to that, what we found in Minnesota in our CRIMNET programs and others, that we've got a situation where you can't identify who the party is absent fingerprints or some other biometric measuring device. So if you give me any of those, a current driver license, for instance, there's no security data behind that, and it costs the state of Minnesota a lot of money to do that if we're going to go forward. Are you going to give us some more information on that very problem?
Mr. Meadows.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Foley, again, another excellent question. The Social Security card, while SSA is working to improve that card itself, really the main tool for verifying that number will be through the Solve verification system, which many of the states are currently using. And I'll come to that in just a moment. But, again, that's one of the federal systems that states will need to link into either directly or through some federated querying system in order to verify the validity of a Social Security number and the association of that number with the individual presenting themselves for a driver's license. Now, in terms of the biometric issue, the regulations as currently drafted, and of course we're still waiting on the final, hopefully sometime this fall in September, we have our fingers crossed for that. There is no requirement for biometric other than some specifications for the photograph, the digital photograph. But the states could presumably go above those requirements if they chose to and institute other degrees of biometric security or data collection in order to verify the individual.
Ms. Meadows, I noticed, Senator Foley, did you have a follow-up question? I noticed earlier when you talked about the federal standards that the states would have to follow, there are things like, the states would have to conduct background checks on certain DMV employees. They would have to ensure the physical security of locations where the DLID cards are produced. They would have to obtain copies of sources of the documents. Does the federal government also intend to impose those same standards on their own people in terms of, you know, like the passports and the Social Security cards that federal employees are issuing out to the public?
Madam Chair, that's an excellent question, and I have to say I don't know. Considering that the state of Colorado has deemed that the passport, or at least last I heard, this could have changed, but at one point Colorado had deemed that the passport was not a sufficiently secure document to be presented for identification in getting a Colorado driver's license. I'm inclined to think not, but the truth is I don't know the exact answer to your question.
So, Mr. Meadows, what I'm hearing is that that has not surfaced in any of the draft regs. That's not surfaced in any of the documentations that the federal government has, that DHS has issued. It's not entered the discussion that in terms of the quality, the type of security that the federal government has imposed on itself.
Well, certainly it has entered into the discussion, and it has been raised in meetings about how perhaps some of the federal processes are not as stringent as what is being expected of the states. That certainly has entered into discussion. But no, the draft regulations do not address any federal process or document requirements. It really is directed at what the states would be expected to do.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In terms of the cost, going back to the cost of implementing this system for the state, I assume that you've taken into consideration the direct cost of hiring employees to process the requests for Real ID. Does it also include the a little bit less direct cost for the counties and the agencies that will be having to respond to all the requests, probably for reissuance of birth certificates, for example, since a lot of people won't have a certified copy of a birth certificate, and I would expect that there'll be a lot of pressure on those types of agencies to that at least temporarily might require additional employees to be hired as well.
Mr. Meadows.
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Olson, that's a good question. The cost estimate that NCSL, NGA, and AMVA developed does take into consideration all of those DMV costs, additional personnel, additional hardware, additional software, additional connectivity. I am not sure if it takes into consideration costs to any other levels of government that might be responsible for reissuing birth certificates or certifying birth certificates, that sort of thing. I can certainly check. Considering that it was the three state-related organizations that did the assessment, I'm assuming that cost estimate does not. Our $11 billion estimate is very conservative, so those costs that you raised, I think, would only increase the price tag.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
On that funding level, and I take it that you're familiar with Colorado, and they tend to be kind of the leaders in the nation. But even there, it's similar to the passport thing. I just renewed my passport, and in a little over 2 months, anyhow, to get it back. And the only way I got it back within that time period is that I had to go to my United States senator or the two of them, and we got the early issuance. But if we do the same thing in the local government, the counties that we're talking about, then people in Minnesota aren't going to stand for that, waiting for months without a driver's license or without some other type of thing and being denied access to the security pieces connected with air travel and other things. So it seems to me that, first of all, we haven't really accomplished too much to on the federal level to deliver those things. And secondly, that there's no funding stream there except from the states themselves.
Well, Senator Foley, I think that your comment bears on the capacity of the systems to be able to process the different plug-ins that are coming from different states. So I'd like for Mr. Meadows to continue. Perhaps he'll be able to give us more information on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to respond by saying that, the issues that you raised are some of the same comments and concerns that we're hearing from state legislators all across the country, that passport lines are growing, the delay in getting a passport is growing, the concern about what kind of reaction residents may have in having to wait for a driver's license or a state-issued identification card, the fact that the convenience of renewing through the mail or online will be obviated, and that residents will now have to take time to present personally at a DMV office, that those DMV offices will have to be secured in some fashion, which could mean a reduction in the convenience of the locations of those DMV facilities. So these are some of the concerns that we're hearing everywhere. Just as a couple examples, there is a discussion in Kansas where currently driver's licenses are managed and issued through county offices, that there will have to be some kind of consolidation or centralization of those services so that the county-based system might not match with Real ID expectations. Senator Vandepute from Texas, NCSL's now immediate past president, testified before a U.S. Senate subcommittee back in March for us on Real ID, and she noted that they were expecting to hire hundreds of new DMV staff in order to process Real ID applications if the state chose to comply, and that their DMV was estimating that this would be massive delays, massive lines, lots of new staff required, and that they have already planned to post at all DMV offices notification to the public that the delays, the line, and the cost is relative to the federally adopted Real ID Act, and here's the contact information for your Texas, your senators in Congress from Texas and your local congressman, you know, basically saying, don't blame Austin. This didn't come from Austin. A little bit more about the verification systems. The Act contemplates that states will need to have access to a number of national or federal databases, only one of which is currently fully operational. The one that is operational is the SOLVE system. That's the Social Security Administration system. At this point in time, only one, the SOLVE system, is operational. Almost all state DMVs currently do access the SOLVE database to verify Social Security numbers through a portal provided by AMVA, the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators. Regarding the SAVE system, which relates to immigration status, all 50 states do have MOUs, Memorandums of Understanding, with DHS to access SAVE, and at least 20 DMVs across the nation do query the SAVE system to verify lawful presence. The EVE system, which relates to birth certificates and vital records, there are currently 49 of 56 jurisdictions without the necessary software to access EVE, though it is installed, and 53 of 56 DMV jurisdictions lack connectivity to the EVE hub. So 49 of 56 do not have the software. 53 of 56 don't have the necessary connectivity that would be required to comply with Real ID. And this is according to the DHS plan submitted to Congress for the spending of that $40 million, and that was issued in June. And that's the justification for spending that grant money for EVE connectivity so that the states can connect with that. And this is particularly what the grant money you'll receive from or via Kentucky could be used for.
Mr. Meadows, there's an assumption here, though, that there's a kind of a database already established, and that this $4 million to connect to EVE is actually going to just buy you the cord to plug in. Is EVE, though, all established? I mean, does every person born in the United States since, you know, Ms. Pontius' 86-year-old mother, I mean, is that all that information in some place already, or does that have to be created, too?
Fantastic question, Madam Chair. And the answer is it's in process, but it is not complete, not by any means. So the collection of the data or the pointer, the development of that pointer system to point to the appropriate data is in process. But no, it is not a complete, quote-unquote, database yet.
So it's actually a two-tier challenge here is the database is not complete because, as you say, I mean, every hospital, every place that gives out birth certificates, I mean, that feed into the database is yet in process of creation. And then we have to think about the second tier, which is what you talked about. How many states have yet to be able to plug into that?
That's correct.
So the where is all this information stored? In Kentucky?
No. The idea for many of these systems is that they would be pointer systems or query systems, not necessarily central repositories of data. But many of this is pending the final regulations as to how they will operate or what kind of secondary verification processes would be acceptable in order to verify and issue a real ID. So some of these questions are still pending, but your point is very accurate that it is a two-tiered problem. One is connectivity, and then the other is simply assurance that the information you're querying is available.
Mm-hmm. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Meadows, I know you're with NCSL, but where did this idea originate? I'm hearing from the feds, but more specifically, is it a particular agency, department? This has been talked about a long time, about a federal ID, and there's a number of private sector businesses that have been spiking the ball into the feds for a long time. Even before 9/11, after 9/11, it was really hyped up in Washington by lobbyists. And I'd like to know, from your perspective, is this driven by a private sector desire to sell the government technology, or is it a federal government-inspired thing? And if so, what agency and what department really wants this?
Mr. Meadows.
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator Limmer. The history of Real ID, as I understand it, is that the 9/11 Commission, when they filed their report, included one line in the report noting that states needed to improve the security and the reliability of the driver's license and state-issued identification cards, since many of the 9/11 terrorists were carrying and boarded aircraft using a legitimately issued state driver's license. Congressman Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin took that and developed the Real ID. That legislation was pending in the House and did have a hearing in the U.S. House, but did not get traction. In its place, somewhat in its place, Senator Collins from Maine and several other senators developed a negotiated rulemaking process for improving state-issued driver's licenses and identification cards, and improved cooperation between the states and the federal government for identity verification that was included in the 9/11 Commission implementing legislation in 2004. That process pulled together a whole variety of interested parties, including NCSL, including the governors, including the motor vehicle administrators, including privacy advocates, including Social Security Administration, DHS, a whole host of interested parties, with the intention of bringing them to a table and developing a process and developing an improved identification card. That committee or that process met once before Congressman Sensenbrenner's legislation was inserted into must-pass legislation, must-pass spending legislation for the Indonesia tsunami relief and Iraq and Afghanistan war funding in 2005. So it was inserted in that legislation. It did not have a hearing in connection with that legislation. It did not have a hearing on the Senate side, and it was passed. And that's how we now have Real ID. The Department of Homeland Security is tasked with developing the regulations and is in the process of now assimilating all of the comments received on the March draft into final regs that are expected in September.
Madam Chair,
Senator Limmer,
Minnesota's history on protecting simple things like driver license records and addresses of people in relationship to their driver license plate on their car, we protect. And since that time, the private sector has repeatedly assaulted the legislature in order to create opportunities for them to gain that information, to restore their ability to get that information as a customer database. And I don't think that's any exaggeration of how I'm characterizing their efforts. And I just shudder to think if there's records like are on the screen here of single location documentation of every American in the country, how that would be a wonderful cache of information that a private sector user could use. Is there any guarantees in the federal legislation that would protect this information from getting in the hands of people that aren't quite as virtuous as what the bill is intended to be, what this federal law is intended to be, and use it for their own gain? Was there any discussion? Probably not, if there weren't any hearings. But I'd like to know if there's any protection from outside interests.
Mr. Meadows.
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator. There are some protections, or at least there is some instruction to DHS that protections need to be put in place. DHS asserts that one of the main protections for private information is the fact that there is not a creation of a central national database of all of this information, so that there is some diffusion either among systems or among the states of this information. NCSL asserts that the best way to prevent, you know, the counterfeiting of driver's licenses is also to make sure that the cards themselves are diffused among the 50 states as opposed to being one central form and one common format. So the privacy issues are of concern. In fact, at NCSL's annual meeting last week, there was language inserted into our Real ID Action Calendar resolution relative to privacy protection and biometric data. So NCSL is also now on record as being concerned about that protection as the final regulations and any fixes that Congress may adopt for the law are taken up. DHS has done some work on privacy concerns. When they issued the draft regulations, they also issued a privacy impact analysis. So it's not an issue that's lost, but that doesn't necessarily guarantee that it's fully addressed either.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemire.
In the federal act, is there a requirement for biometric information to be placed into these records? Is that also on track to accumulate biometrics?
Mr. Meadows.
Madam Chair, my understanding is that biometric data is other than a digital image, a photograph, that no other biometric data is currently required. I certainly can look into that and reconfirm, but that's my current understanding.
Senator Lemire.
Madam Chair, just as a historical record, about 5-6 years ago, firms that were trying to promote a biometric system for the state of Minnesota convinced the House and Senate to give their firms $100,000 to $130,000 in order for them to use that money to sell us on the need for biometric data accumulation. Now imagine a salesman going to you saying, give me $130,000 and I'll use it to promote the product to you. And that's basically what the state of Minnesota, the legislature, approved in that one line item operation. Those companies are out there, and they're not only continually, they're kind of like camp followers. They know there's a trail of money, and they have a little portion of technology that they really want to sell. And a 9/11 event simply plays into their hands, and maybe a nervous legislature or a Congress wants to make sure that they send a message back to their public that says, yes, we're concerned and we want to do something. And it's very tempting to try and pursue that type of thing, but some of them are very good companies, reputable firms, and others are nothing more than selling snake oil. And I think this type of subject matter has to be approached very studiously. You need to ask lots of questions, and you almost have to put yourself in a mindset of pretending you're unscrupulous as some of these other people, and how can this information be abused? And then you start developing a line of questions that really should be used when one starts to analyze this type of thing. I am kind of concerned about if a state says no to this type of thing, and then there's a list of reactions by the federal government, boarding a commercial aircraft, entering federal buildings, entering nuclear power plants. I think entering federal buildings, there is a legitimate need for citizens to enter government buildings. I'd really like to see how that one would be enforced in the courts. I guess I could understand entering nuclear power plants, but I've gone into nuclear power plants, and you have quite a background research on you anyway. But boarding a commercial aircraft, I'm just wondering about the states that just happen to have a flying hub in their state, similar to Minnesota. And if the state of Minnesota decided to say no, I would tend to think that that could probably cripple an entire aircraft company, if not an industry. And has the aircraft industry said anything about this in reaction to that type of scenario? I'm just wondering just how workable this really is. And as every state, as we've seen in the last 10 to 20 years, no state says no to the federal government anymore. And the federal government continues to encroach in that definition of federalism that gives states rights. And the federal government in the last 6 to 8 to 10 years seems to be crunching into states' rights all the time. And has there been any discussion about the states' rights relationship to this national edict that's coming down?
So, Mr. Meadows, three questions. One, if you could share whether or not the airline industry has weighed in. Two, what are the, I guess, issues with respect to states' rights and federalism issue? And then I guess the second, the other question, Senator Limmer, was?
I think it would boil down to two questions,
okay.
Madam Chair.
So, Mr. Meadows.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The airline industry, that's a very good question. Now I'm going to have to go check and see what sort of statements the airline associations and the industry have been making on this. I know that they obviously do have a lot of concern about any restrictions or any requirements that the Department of Homeland Security or TSA might impose that further restricts or complicates travel. So I'm quite positive they do have an interest in this, but I don't honestly know which, what their position specifically is at this point in time. Regarding federalism and states' rights, that is absolutely at the core of NCSL's interest in the issue. We see this as a real challenge to the 10th Amendment. The response from DHS or the federal government is largely that it's not a mandate because the states don't have to comply. You don't have to implement Real ID, and the consequence does not fall on the state. The consequence falls on your electorate. So they don't necessarily view it as a mandate in the same way that we are at this point in time. But, no, we do absolutely view this as a federalism concern and an encroachment of the federal government on a state authority. And one of the main reasons that this troubles NCSL is because the states themselves, after 9/11 and even before 9/11, recognized potential deficiencies or problems in their driver's license and identification card processes and documentation, and were taking steps in their own ways to address those or to correct those. I staff NCSL's Transportation Committee out of the Washington office, and one of my vice chairs this past year was a senator from Indiana who noted that they had plans to completely revamp their driver's license system and had that in process so that they were moving in that direction even before Real ID came along. But mandating federal standards or stipulating federal standards takes it to a new level that that does concern many state legislators all across the country. And I also want to note that some states are looking at alternatives. It didn't pass, but I know that there was a bill in the Oregon Senate that called for a study of what would happen or what the impacts would be for the state not to comply with Real ID, but instead to perhaps subsidize passports. So some states are looking at, or at least individual legislators are looking at what alternatives could be to the Real ID itself.
Hmm. In the interest of time, because we do have three other individuals who are going to be testifying, if the members could hold off their question, Mr. Meadows is almost at the end of his presentation, then we can come back and ask him any other follow-up questions. Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to note on this slide that the draft regulations do state that the student and exchange visitor information system will be completed before May of 2008. That's the SEVIS connection with SAVE. And I also want to highlight, relative to some of the funding questions that have come up, that DHS currently expects that the states will pay either a fee or a per transaction or per connection fee for accessing these systems. So there's not any funding envisioned for the operators of these systems to service all of these new Real ID requests. That's expected to be a state expense as well. Very quickly, the draft regulations, according to the draft regulations, the Act does not create, as I said, a national database. It leaves the decision on how to conduct the exchanges in the hands of the states, and DHS supports the development of a federated querying system but will not operate or control the system. That federated querying system will query only, will not retain the data, and that it will be voluntary. States may choose to establish direct access to these federal databases or systems, or they could combine direct access with partial use of a common service, or verify the applicant data against the reference database in some other manner. So the draft regulations don't stipulate precisely how states are to access these verification systems and really leave it as a bit of a free-for-all for the states to determine individually or collectively how they're going to access these this information. No federal agency will operate the data exchanges affecting non-commercial driver's licensing. As I said, states will need to work out the business process and the data access rules necessary to implement the state-to-state data exchange, and this will need to take place before the May 11, 2008 deadline if you're going to be able to issue a Real ID compliant driver's license. So the governance structure for that system will need to be devised and set in place. And there are some discussions currently underway of how that governance structure might be set up and what the system could look like, particularly with the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators. If some of these Real ID querying or pointer systems will be modeled on the commercial driver's license CIDLIS system. Privacy concerns. At the federal level, only the Driver's Privacy Protection Act of 1994 governs motor vehicle records, but its protections are limited. It governs the use and disclosure of personal information stored in state motor vehicle records. The draft regulations propose that each state submit, as part of the Real ID Act certification process, a written comprehensive security plan. So a lot of these privacy concerns are being punted down to the state level. And I can touch on some of the machine-readable technology issues if the question arises. In terms of what's happening in Congress, there have been a couple of hearings, a couple of discussions about Real ID, both in committee and on the floor of the Senate. Senators Akaka from Hawaii and Sununu from New Hampshire have introduced legislation that would call for the repeal of Real ID and replace it with the negotiated rulemaking that was originally put in place in 2004. It provides for a specific authorization and provides for additional privacy protections. There are new co-sponsors in the 110th Congress, including Senators Leahy and Tester. Senator Collins also has legislation introduced that extends the implementation deadline, ensures the electronic verification systems are available prior to states being required to use them. That's one of NCSL's major concerns, is that the states are going to be called upon to do something that simply cannot be done. Senator Collins' legislation would also establish a post-draft rulemaking, negotiated rulemaking committee to review how well DHS responded to comments on the draft regulations and what, if any, legislative or regulatory corrections or changes might be needed after the final rules are issued. On the House side, Congressman Allen from Maine has introduced legislation that largely mirrors Senator Akaka's legislation, and it does have a number of co-sponsors. And I previously mentioned some of the money discussions that have taken place in Congress, particularly the $300 million appropriations that Senator Lamar Alexander tried to advance. I also want to note that Real ID has been referenced in a couple of other bills. We're very concerned about mission creep relative to Real ID. At this point in time, if a state does not issue a Real ID license, the holder of that non-compliant license cannot board an aircraft, cannot enter a nuclear power plant, cannot enter a federal building, or may not do other things that the secretary determines. And we're concerned that that open-ended question is being tested. In particular, you've seen Real ID referenced in voter rights legislation on Capitol Hill, in federal housing subsidy program legislation, and then most specifically in the recent immigration bill. There was an expanded use of the Real ID to make it a requirement for employment eligibility, so that you would have to have a Real ID in order to be eligible for employment in the United States. Now, NCSL, and I did distribute a copy of the letter that NCSL sent to Senators Baucus and Tester supporting their amendment to strip that language from the immigration bill. Their amendment actually never came to a vote, and the immigration bill, as you know, ended up being pulled from the floor before a final vote. But I just want to highlight that Real ID is cropping up in a couple other areas, we need to be vigilant to how it may otherwise be used. Also, I want to note that in a recent release from the White House, the administration is seeking voluntary state partners that might be willing to share their Department of Motor Vehicle photos and records with E-Verify as their new immigration initiative. So there are some Real ID implications there as well. On the state side, this past session has seen 130 bills in 44 states. 66% of those bills have been more or less anti-Real ID. About 20% have suggested compliance in some form, or either in full or on a conditional basis with Real ID. And the others study the bill. As I said, one of the Oregon bills looked at the prospect of subsidizing passports for Oregon residents. Some bills have looked at alternative driving certificates or funding questions. There's up-to-date information about state legislation and everything that NCSL is tracking about Real ID at our Real ID website, which is ncsl.org/realid. In terms of NCSL activity, very quickly, I've already mentioned the report on costs and recommended improvements to make Real ID operable. That was issued in September of 2006. We submitted comments in conjunction with AMBA and the National Governors Association on the draft regulations. Senator Vandepute, NCSL's president at the time, testified before Senator Akaka's subcommittee in March. We have testified in several states in just this fashion to make sure that state legislators are aware of the federal regulations and the developments in Washington. We are lobbying actively for at least $1 billion in startup costs from Congress to the states to launch Real ID. Our policy calls for Congress to fix and fund Real ID. And if those fixes and funding do not materialize by December 31st of this year, we're in a position to call for repeal as of January 1st. And this is my contact information. I and Molly Ramsdell, also out of our Washington office, would certainly be available to you with any questions or for any follow-up comments or questions you may have. And it's a pleasure to be here, and I certainly would welcome any additional questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Meadows. We welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee the chair of the Public Safety and Civil Justice Committee in the House, as well as Representative Leanne Lilly, who is a member of the House. Representative Mullery, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, welcome. Mr. Meadows, just one question. How many states have affirmatively adopted state legislation to say we shall not comply?
As a couple examples, Montana has actually adopted statute stating that they will not comply. Several states have adopted resolutions stating that they will not comply, but that obviously falls slightly short of actually preventing the state from compliance. Refusal to comply bills were introduced in Maine, Montana, New Hampshire, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Washington. Idaho adopted legislation that would refuse to fund Real ID. So those are a couple examples. Maine was the first state to actually adopt a resolution, and it was unanimous in both houses, stating that they would not comply with Real ID. That falls a bit short, obviously, of statutory language, but considering that the Secretary of State in Maine, who is responsible for their motor vehicle operations, is appointed by the legislature, I suspect that he'd be listening to that resolution. Mm-hmm.
Well, you should add Minnesota to the list of states that introduced legislation but didn't pass. So, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Meadows? Mr. Meadows will remain throughout the hearing today. So as we hear from the other participants, if there are any questions that sort of falls in his area, we will have him come back to the table to answer questions. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry. I do have one question. Last session, I carried a bill that had to do with storing information and the security of credit card information that can be harvested by those looking to misuse it for a number of different purposes. And when we put this type of personal information in one place, it makes it a target of potential harvesters for illegal purposes. So I guess I'm wondering, has consideration been given to those concerns? Is there any software that would be available to help protect that information? Is anyone working on that issue? And then kind of a related question is, because we're required to allow other states to have access to our information, how much leeway would we have to put restrictions on how they store or use information they would receive from us?
Mr. Meadows?
Madam Chair, those are very good points, and many of the and frankly are largely undefined at this point in time as we're waiting on some of the draft regulations or as we're waiting for the negotiated governance structure for the federated querying system to develop, et cetera. So a lot of those things, I think, are still in play and probably will be in play for a while. The retention of documents and retention of information is also something that would be negotiated. The states are required to retain documents that are presented. So even if you're querying other states, you very well might be expected to retain copies of that information in your state's database or files. So I think that there are a lot of issues that you've raised that relate both to the financial services security concerns that could relate to this as well. And unfortunately, a lot of those answers are pending.
Members, Ms. Katie Engler is going to come up and speak to us, and she is going to, I think this question is a very good entree into her presentation, because she's going to be speaking specifically to Minnesota and looking at sort of our treatment of some of these private information and what issues have raised now for her and her staff about how do we treat information that we get from other states, and how do we treat information that other states get from us, because there will be differential standards of what's private and what's not. So, Senator Limmer, if that's your question.
Madam Chair, it may be a good – my question might be a good segue for Ms. Engler to answer, but since we have someone from Washington – in the Real ID Act, is there a provision that allows states to, like in similar federal law, to write more stringent protections into the law than what the federal government requires?
Mr. Meadows?
Madam Chair, the Real ID Act sets the minimum federal standards for the Real ID. You do have the option of instituting stricter or additional standards, but Real ID does set that floor for the federal standards, but many of those federal standards do relate to the querying between the states, the verification of one driver, one record, and the other data that we discussed.
Madam Chair, the one question or the one issue or concern or problem that I see is if one state has a more stringent requirement of data sharing, and if it goes into a large database that can be reached by a variety of states, how would Minnesota enforce its state law in its protection of data when someone in another state decides to use it or abuse it? I don't think Minnesota state law could be enforceable in any other state, so it would be interesting to see if the federal government has a fix or a patch on that type of thing, recognizing more stringent state requirements and at the same time allowing for a database sharing. I don't know if that's possible to do in light of this type of a mix of information.
Ms. Meadows, thank you for the information, and I'm sure there'll be other questions that we might need you to come back up to the table. So thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ms. Engler. Let's see. This one. Members, Ms. Engler has provided us a memo that's behind your third tab, right? Your third tab. And I think she has a presentation, but this her memo and the information here is background information for you. So I don't think she's necessarily going to be She's not going to necessarily be going off of the memo, but this is very good background information for you to take a look at. Ms. Engler, thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Katie Engler. I'm with the Department of Administration, and what I am going to be working from this morning has the Senate Judiciary Committee at the top, and then it says Real ID Act. And then the first underlined point is Minnesota's culture of privacy. So I believe that's in your binder. So you might want to find that, because that's what I'm going to be working from this morning.
That's the second document behind the other one. So you have a memo that was sent to me, and then it may be stapled in the second document behind that. Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As you know, the Information Policy Analysis Division really works predominantly in two areas. One is access to government of information. The other is the issue of privacy. And the focus today is on privacy issues, and particularly issues that come up because of the Real ID Act. And so I thought it might be helpful for you to have some context, and then I have a scenario for us to look at to try to help make concrete some of the issues that are brought forward. So first of all, Minnesota is recognized as being very protective of an individual's privacy. In fact, a publication called Privacy Journal, which has been published, as its publisher indicates, before there was email and before there were databases, et cetera, ranked Minnesota second in protecting individual privacy among the states in 2002. I communicated with the publisher, Robert Ellis Smith, this week, and he confirmed that's his most recent ranking, but he also offered that it was unlikely that Minnesota's position would change if a ranking would be done today. Also, I gave you in the second heading just some snippets of concerns that have been raised about privacy issues concerning the Real ID Act. And what I really want to do, at the bottom of page one, there's a quotation from something called Cryptogram, which is authored by a gentleman named Bruce Schneier, who is recognized among technology and privacy people as someone who has some really thoughtful positions on issues relating to technology and privacy. And I would like to raise or point out a couple of things. In part, he says, one wonders how vulnerable this system of systems, which is all of these state systems against which queries will be run, wonders how vulnerable the system of systems will be to data loss or identity theft, which goes to Senator Olson's question. And then if you turn to the second page, it says, there is no clear guidance on the limits of how the Real ID database would be used. And that goes to some of the questions that Senator Limmer has been asking this morning. So these are concerns that are being asked by or raised by people who are interested in privacy issues. Mr. Meadows indicated that the Department of Homeland Security did a privacy impact assessment of these proposed regulations. And I quoted fairly extensively for you on pages 2 and 3 some of the points from that privacy impact assessment. The first one, DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, does not have authority to control third-party use or potential use of the Real ID credential or associated identifier. In other words, they're leaving it to the states to do that, if it's going to be done. The quotation from page 9, since certain databases will be connected, those are the ones that were listed by Mr. Meadows in his materials, it will be critical from a privacy perspective to clarify which parties control the data systems and which parties have access to the data systems. So those are some of the things that even the Department of Homeland Security, in looking at their regulations, recognized as privacy concerns that come about because of this Real ID Act. If you go to page 3, I've given you a scenario here because I thought it would be helpful to look at a concrete example of how Real ID would work. So Harold and Maude were born and married in Minnesota. Harold was born at home, and no birth certificate was issued. They are retired now and want to divide their time between Texas in the winter and their lake place here in Minnesota in the summer. something we're relatively all familiar with. We have lots of folks who do that. They have decided to make their Texas property their permanent residence. So in order to obtain a driver's license in Texas that is Real ID compliant, they will need to have, and then I've got a list there for you. Mr. Meadows' list was more extensive, but they're going to have a valid, unexpired U.S. passport or a certified copy of their birth certificate, which for Harold is going to be difficult because he doesn't have one. Maud is going to need a certified copy of their marriage certificate to demonstrate her name change. They're going to have to document their Social Security number with a number of different documents, and they're going to need documents that demonstrate their principal residence in Texas. Things like bank statements or utility bills are what's mentioned in the proposed regulations. They have a certain time frame in which they have to have been issued, and a street address is required. They also have to submit to a mandatory facial image capture. Now, Texas is required to keep copies of all of these documents, and they have to verify all of these documents. And one of the verifications is that the names on all of them have to match. So if they don't have their bank statements in the same name as on their birth certificate or other documents, there's going to be a whole issue of, is it the same person? So we have all of that. So first issue. Mr. Meadows mentioned the Driver's Privacy Protection Act, which is the federal law that governs driver's license and motor vehicle records. And there are seven items of data that are protected by that law. And in fact, in your materials, in my portion of your binder, you've got a copy of the Driver's Privacy Protection Act. And in part because there are 14 exceptions to who can have access to this data without the individual's consent. So, but we have some data that are being captured on these documents that will be required to be provided that are not covered by the Driver's Privacy Protection Act. And so in Minnesota, under our presumption that data are public unless you, the legislature, classify it otherwise, we have public items of data. And the one that crossed my mind is that on our birth certificate, our mother's maiden name is listed. And what is one of the most popular questions for, if you forget your password, what would you like your reminder to be? Your mother's maiden name is one of your choices. So now you have a place where you have a public record, unless the legislature acts, where people who have not exactly exemplary ideas in mind can learn your mother's maiden name and now get access to all of your data. So, first issue, should Minnesota provide a classification for the remaining items of data not covered by the Driver's Privacy Protection Act? And I've tried to give you some ideas of some potential concerns here. Yes, is one option. More privacy protection for recipients of Minnesota driver's licenses. Increased protection against identity theft. And a public expectation that these data will be protected. Of concern is an issue that Senator Limmer raised, which is you can provide controls for data here in Minnesota. Once the data leave Minnesota, it's now going to be that other state whose law is going to provide the privacy protection. And so this system is going to be based, in essence, on the weakest protection among the 50 states. Also, in opposition to the issue, or in answering no to the question, classifying the data is going to add some obstacles to exchanges with other states. It might make it more difficult for people to obtain their license in a different state, and it might increase costs. Another issue. Minnesota currently classifies the driver's license photo as private data under our scheme in section 171.07. Basically, in Minnesota, we recognize data stored in any format as being classified. However, I think there could be someone who questions whether or not this digital facial image that's supposed to be captured under the federal law is covered by our state law. And so the question is whether or not you should amend that provision to make sure that everyone understands that that image, no matter how captured, is classified as private data here. Mr. Meadows didn't talk a whole lot about the requirement that there be what they call machine-readable technology on the driver's license. In Minnesota, it's the magnetic strip on the back of our driver's license, and there are data elements in there. And the federal regulations say what standard of machine-readable technology has to be deployed in order to be able to read the data that are stored. And that technology is standard. It's available in the marketplace now, and there's no limit on which parties can have access. In fact, some places deploy those card readers and their facilities to make sure that people meet certain criteria. For example, a bar will use the technology to make sure that the people entering are the correct age in order to consume alcohol. So here the proposed federal regulations talk about a very easily accessible machine-readable technology and really don't put any limits on the use. In fact, the Department of Homeland Security says that they don't have any authority to put any limits on third-party use. So the issue for you becomes, should Minnesota place restrictions on a third party's collection, use, and redisclosure of data stored in that magnetic stripe? Now, in this context, it's raised with a limited set of data. However, several of you are very interested in the broader issue that consumes this one, which is third-party access to and use of government data. So, again, you have some choices to make about whether or not you want to put any restrictions on that data. One thing to think about is that most Minnesotans don't understand how those third parties get access to the data. And most of them wouldn't dream that when the grocery store or a restaurant swipes your driver's license, that they are in fact capturing the data that are stored there, like your name, your address, your height, your driver's license number, that kind of thing. So, third issue. If the Texas Driver's License Agency can't verify the information provided by Herald or MOD, they are prohibited from issuing what's called a real ID compliant driver's license. They can issue a driver's license, but it has to be clearly marked that it doesn't meet the federal standards, which will then prohibit Herald or MOD from using that driver's license to get on probably an aircraft, I don't know, that they or into a federal facility, or the other choice would be the nuclear facility or whatever else the Department of Homeland Security says is required to have that identification. So the other issue is if there's an error in some of the documentation that are being used to do the verification, what is the mechanism that Herald or MOD have in order to correct that? So the issue is, does Minnesota's existing provision regarding the correction of data sufficient? And it is to an extent. Section 1304, Subdivision 4 in the Data Practices Act has a process for correcting government data. However, it's limited to government data. So if the problem is with the bank statement, with the utility bill, there really isn't anything that you've provided statutorily that directs correction mechanisms for Herald or MOD. The other thing that you need to know is that the data correction process in the Data Practices Act takes a long time. I would suspect that the average that people are experiencing right now for the process is about 12 months. Now, that has to do with the fact that if the parties can't agree on how to fix the data, they go off to the Office of Administrative Hearings, they have a contested case hearing, the administrative law judge has to create a record and findings of fact, send it back to the Commissioner of Administration, who then has to issue a final order. But that all takes time. And so if we now have more people needing to correct government data, we're going to have more individuals using this process, and it's probably going to take longer because of the influx of volume for that part of the system. You've already talked a little bit about whether or not data needs to be secured. Certainly under the Data Practices Act, it does in Minnesota, particularly if it's classified as private or confidential. Because Minnesota uses a deputy registrar system for issuing driver's licenses, and at least there used to be one of those stations over at the Sears store over on Rice Street. We have a mix of government and non-government offices providing this service to citizens. And we now are going to have security requirements. How are we going to help counties and private sector people providing these services address the security concerns? How are they going to keep the documents secure? How are they going to keep the data secure? How is it going to be transferred from those locations to the central Division of Motor Vehicle Services here at the Department of Public Safety? All of those things need to be taken into consideration. And you may decide as policymakers that there ought to be some consistent things that each of those deputy registrars need to do in order to protect security. You may want to have some legislation in that area. You may also want to direct that there be auditing to make sure that those things are being done. At the bottom of page 5, another issue is that the proposed federal regulations require that there be security and plans in place for data, documents, and physical sites. Well, under the current Data Practices Act, each individual responsible authority in a government entity has the ability to declare certain information, what we call security information, but it's left to the discretion of each individual government entity. There may be some merit in the legislature providing some uniformity and consistency across all of these agencies by establishing a classification for these security plans so that it's treated the same way across the state rather than having a gap, say, in a county that just hasn't made that declaration. So that's another issue that you may want to consider as policymakers. So in conclusion, on page 6, I've sort of recapped for you the list of policy issues that I see from a privacy perspective that you as legislators may want to consider as Real ID goes forward and give some consideration to the privacy protections that you want to have in place for these data and documents that are being required by this federal legislation. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
No, Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
I'm not sure if this is if I should have asked the prior witnesses either, but I'd like to better understand the practical consequences of not complying with Real ID. We talked about airplanes, nuclear plants, is it any federal building? So I mean, federal courthouse in Minnesota, lawyers couldn't get into it anymore if they didn't have a Real ID.
Mr. Meadows, why don't you come back up to the table? Ms. Engler, you can stay too, because it'll go back and forth. Either of you will, if you want to answer that question. Mr. Meadows.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As currently written, that's correct. If Minnesota were not to comply with Real ID and issue compliant driver's licenses, then the attorney in question would need to have a passport in order to get into that federal courthouse. But as was raised earlier, there is some question as to whether or not that actually would pass muster if it were to be sued in court. But that's obviously still a pending question since we haven't hit the implementation deadline for Real ID.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Neville.
So does the Real ID Act, the federal law, allow for passports in lieu of Real ID? You said that they could use a passport to get into the courthouse.
That's
is that
correct.
An alternative?
Mr. Meadows.
Madam Chair, that's correct, because the passport is a federally issued
identification
credential. So Real ID only applies to state driver's licenses and state-issued identification cards.
Well, Madam Chair, the reason I'm following up on this is I was at the NCSL convention last week and attended this seminar on this topic, and somebody was actually suggesting that that's the better solution is just to use the passport more universally for access to airplanes, power plants, and federal buildings. I got the impression that wasn't already in the law, but you're telling me that it is, that in lieu of that, the passport would be an alternative identification document for all these other purposes?
Mr. Meadows.
Just to clarify, it's not in the law that the passport can be used in lieu of a Real ID. The passport is already a credential that can be used for all of those purposes.
Okay.
This law simply states that as of May 11, 2008, a state-issued driver's license or identification card cannot be used for those purposes. if it does not comply with Real ID.
So if we chose in Minnesota not to comply with the Real ID in terms of our driver's license, our citizens could still get on planes, go into federal buildings if they got a passport.
That's correct.
Mr. Meadows. Ms. Meadows, has NCSL done an analysis of what the comparing the cost to for all the states to be in compliant with the Real ID Act versus if every citizen was just issued a passport, what the cost comparisons are?
Madam Chair, I haven't actually run the numbers, but we obviously have estimated that it would be $11 billion over 5 years for the states to comply with Real ID. You know, on the back of an envelope, a passport currently is about $100 and would have a 10-year life for an adult. So that's, you know, the numbers that would be in play.
Interesting. Senator Lummer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was listening carefully to Senator Neville's comments, and he was putting things in question in reference to an attorney entering a federal building, but what about plaintiffs and defendants and just common everyday citizens? Would they actually be denied access to the courts to have their proverbial day in court under this federal legislation? The way it's described to us, I think they might be. So you have a due process issue that could be emerging. And I also was thinking beyond the courts. There's veterans that need to get veteran records. Their DD-214s that commonly require them to be there in person for identification purposes so that that particular individual record would be given to the right person. I'm thinking of in my business, in the real estate business, sometimes you have VA loans and you have to get validation of other people. So now you have housing issues that might be required. Not to mention all of the federal housing programs that are out there, not only in mortgages, FHA and VA, but also other specific programs to individual citizens that may fall into low-income housing requirements, and they're trying to find a place for their family. I just think that this particular bill, and it seems to be described, if it's accurate, with very little hearing, doesn't seem to be really ferreted out in the best way to determine how far-reaching this particular bill has, and almost a near, what I would call a draconian effort to enforce. If you don't do it our way, we won't allow you to participate in the benefits that the government will offer everyone else. And so those are concerns and issues that I have with the federal government going down this path. It certainly raises questions of equal rights and due process and fair access. And if you happen to have an opinion different from the federal government, well, you will be forced to comply one way or the other. And I don't know if I know we have other ramifications in not only state and federal law that try to exact behavior, but this just seems to need a lot more thinking out. And the federal government, whoever it is that's behind all of these ideas, whether it's people that are elected or whether it's the bureaucracy or whether it's some lobbyist that wants to make a little more money for a client, and so they'll affect federal legislation that only one or two or a very small group of parties that happen to make the technology to provide this requirement, they need to have a little bit more thought in this, because this just seems to be too huge of a step, too fast for states to comply with. And I don't know if these thoughts will go back to whoever it is in the federal bureaucracy on this type of thing, but I suppose it's up to us and the states to determine whether or not we're going to comply, and it doesn't seem like we're given too many options. It's just take it or leave it and suffer consequences. And yet those of us who've tried to deal with this type of database accumulation have gone through some of these problems already. The security of government files, the opportunity for third parties to take advantage of, even when it's considered illegal to use, they seem to get it, that the fairness, the access, the due process, all of these issues come up, and I think they probably have been discussed in much far more detail on the state level than what I see in the federal government. So it's probably a comment, but I think it's something that needs to be put on record.
Well, Senator Limmer, I think that that's the intent of this hearing, is to get the information to us. Because I think you hit it right on the head that somehow this regulation has kind of flown, you know, under the radar of all of us. Many, many of us at the state level, our different agencies have had to really deal with the regulations. They've wrestled with it. They've looked at it. They've been operating under great amounts of uncertainty. And I think that it's time for us here at the legislature to really hear what are the concerns. And I think that if we feel compelled, I think that it might be maybe even a little bit too late, but, you know, nothing's ever too late for us to interject our input and make sure that we communicate that to our other elected colleagues at the congressional level. Because at this point, I think that our different agencies, and Commissioner McCormick is going to be presenting to us too, I am hearing the concerns from our agencies about how they're going to be complying. And I think what we need to hear from them is what are some of the things that we will need to do to prepare for compliance unless we take other steps, and what they will be looking at in terms of the barriers, and then specifically what are the cost, but that's just sort of what can be counted. I mean, I think there are a number of other costs that have not yet been factored into the conversation. And what I'm hearing from Mr. Meadows is they're going to say, this is what we want you to do, and then states, you go and figure it out. And I think that we need to have that conversation, and we need to take some steps. What I would like is I'm going to have Mr. Meadows comment. Senator Olson, did you have a question or a comment? And then Representative Mullery, Senator Foley, but I would really like Commissioner McCormick to come up, because I think that we need to hear from her. And then we'll keep all three of them at the table, and we'll then ask questions. Okay?
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
I'm concerned with time elements. I thought we would be through here by 11, and I made some plans accordingly. And so could we hear the testimony that that these folks have or are going to give first, and then move
sure.
into the.
Sure. If you will, can we do that, Representative Mullery? All right, Commissioner McCormick, please come up. You may stay, or you may vacate your seat, Ms. Engler.
Stay there.
Commissioner McCormick, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to clarify, I'm the director of the Division of Driver and Vehicle Services, not commissioner, and that I'm with the Department of Public Safety.
Well, I thought you had gotten a promotion when I looked at the agenda. So it's not that I was being disrespectful to you when I call you Ms. McCormick, but that my staff promoted you. Well, I think you kind of want to clarify that maybe some of the things we want you to do are not quite yet at your pay grade. Please proceed.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'll just be going through the document that's entitled, it has Department of Public Safety on the letterhead at the top, and it talks about the impact of Real ID on Minnesota. And first of all, just to clarify what the costs are that we at DVS have estimated previously when we testified before the Transportation Committee in the spring. We had estimated our costs to be $10.3 million, and that was our comment to the Department of Homeland Security. But in gathering further information, especially as it related to programming and upgrading our system, we are now estimating that the one-time costs would be $19.5 million, and we'd have $9 million in ongoing costs, so it would amount to about $45 million over the five-year period when we would be complying with the Real ID. In terms of our current compliance with what the Real ID Act requires, Minnesota has really superseded the identification and residency requirements in the Real ID. We did that through a rulemaking in 2002, and we require a primary and secondary document in order to be able to apply for a license. Although there are a few documents that we have on our primary and secondary document list that aren't allowable under the Real ID, so it's the Real ID is narrower than what we would allow. And as a result, we did make comments to that effect to the department and stated that we believed that states should be able to allow additional documents, and we named the specific ones that we felt should be included. We have a central issuance process which does help promote security. In other words, you can apply at any of our offices, and we do look at identification documents at that office, but then all that information is transmitted to our central office. We review it again as we issue the driver's license or identification cards, and then we have that sent for production, and then it's mailed to the address of the applicant, which then demonstrates to us that it is an actual address. The post office works very well with us in that if it's sent to mailbox, et cetera, for a post office box, that gets sent back to DVS. Those are not, they have to go to an actual residence address unless we have a specific reason. For instance, some cities, all the mailboxes are in post office boxes, but we have that all worked through with the post office so that we are able to demonstrate that the person is at the residence that they have on their card. And then we also have implemented anti-fraud initiatives. We did that in 2002. We require annual training on identity documents, not only to all of our staff, but we have yearly seminars with our deputy registrars and our DL agents, and we update them on fraudulent document training at those seminars. And so we do believe that we do have a system in place that does help us to try to identify fraudulent documents in terms of our driver license issuance process. The requirements that are especially noteworthy that we would need to address, first of all, initial background checks on all card production staff, which would then not only include our own staff, but also our driver license agents and all of their staffs. We have 125 driver license agents' offices who have numerous staff at their locations, as well as all staff that are involved in our application and issuing process, and card vendor, the vendors that we work with and their staff. So we're talking about 1,500 additional background checks. And that we're estimating would cost about $94,500. Now, all DVS staff for the past 6 years, we have done initial background checks and reference checks on all of our staff that work for us because of the fact that we do have such confidential and private information that we're dealing with, and we're dealing with collecting taxes on behalf of the state. So we do believe we do need to do those background checks. But we have staff. Our average length of retention in terms of staff years is upwards past 20 years. So we have a lot of staff that have never had any background checks because those weren't done previously. And so those would have to be done on a regular basis according to the Real ID. And then in order to do that, we would really need to set up a security unit because we'd have to have people that were processing, keeping track of all these background checks, as well as ensuring that they were checking on references, et cetera, and clearing up issues that may come up in terms of the background check process. There's other requirements that are listed in there in terms of checking on that, and it includes getting warrant information and things like that, and we've corresponded in our comments to the Department of Homeland Security that they don't provide any detail on how we would go about doing that process. And I would just say that in general, that that's one of our concerns, is that while we certainly support the improving the security of our driver license issuing system, we are very concerned that there's not enough detail so that we would even be able to implement it at this point in time. And obviously, as Mr. Meadows talked about, you know, once the final rules come out, which I understand from a recent call that I took, that I was part of, that with the National Governors Association, that now they're talking about, you know, late September or October as being the date when we'll see the final rules. If then they have to work, they said in the call that there's a lot of legalities that must that still need to be worked through. So then the fact that we would also have to do facility audits of all places where we issue driver's licenses. We have 96 exam stations, which includes our central office, 125 DL agent offices, and 6 correctional facilities that our staff go to so that we're able to assist in the issuance process and take applications. So we would have to have all this in place and ensure that we have a good process in terms of auditing, but those standards in which to do this audit still have not been provided to us. The implementation of the online verification systems are of great concern to us because of the fact that, as if you look in the next bullet points regarding our challenges, one of our major challenges is that our legacy mainframe system does not have a relational database, and it's a mainframe system, which means everything is a programmed request to get information. You can't talk or communicate with other information systems. The information system was developed in the 80s. It's certainly good for holding the amount of data, and it's a very secure system, but we would need to migrate to a new platform. And we are planning a redesign. We were authorized to put that redesign plan together and bring forward a plan to the governor and the legislature, which we are in the process of doing, but we still don't have a timetable as yet until we've secured funding for that proposal. And so we are not able to implement the online verification systems at this particular time. The only system that we do participate in is the CIDLIS system, which is the commercial driver license information system that they talk about. We are able to work through that connection because we connect with AMVA, AMVA's information system. The American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators has an information system that all 50 states connect to, and it's a pointer system, so that if we need to check on a commercial driver or a problem driver for another state, we connect to AMVANET, and AMVANET points us to whatever state we're looking at. So when drivers apply for our licenses, we're able to check their records at their prior jurisdiction that they have on their driver's license. So we have that system in place, and we are participating in the EVE system that was talked about, but we're participating in a passive way. The Vital Records Office in the Department of Health and DVS have maintained a very close working relationship for the last 6 years, and we work with the Department of Health, who does provide data to some other states that are already in that system, and we work with them in doing that process. So we are part of a pilot, but we are not able to fully connect until we would get this new information system in place. So in addition to that, we would also need to upgrade our driver license contract in order to meet the standards. We are in the process of getting ready to issue a request for information for that reason, as well as the fact that in 2009 we would need to renegotiate our contract. And the surge of customers that would need to re-enroll would could exceed our existing capacity in terms of being able to meet the demand, since we're right now at pretty much capacity in terms of numbers of staff, in terms of meeting the needs of our current customers. So we would think that we could be talking about adding between 5 and 20 minutes to each transaction in terms of working with each customer, because we would have to spend time going through documents for every person that would come into our office, versus right now we would only do that on initial applications. We issue about 1.6 million driver's licenses on a yearly basis. We have one of the shorter renewal times, probably for a four-year turnaround renewal time. A lot of states are at 6 and 8 years. So for that reason, it would be very difficult for us to get that done any sooner than trying to work with each customer as well as keep up with the renewals. We do not do any online driver's license issuing in terms of through the mail or online. We do online renewals if there's no change in information with our agents, but in terms, nothing is done from home, because we believe we need the person there to be able to identify that person from previous records, so that we know that's the actual person. We're authenticating it by them coming in to do the renewal or duplicate licensure process. So we may need to hire additional staff, increase our service hours. We may need to increase the number of facilities in order to accommodate the volume. We'll have to purchase additional equipment and obviously create and plan a good information campaign for the public, so that they would understand what they would need to be bringing in order to get a driver's license, because that's where we already have a lot of people that just assume if they've been married, they can come in and just change their driver's license, and they need to bring with them identification from with their prior name as well as their new married name, so that we are able to authenticate them. And these kinds of situations would be increased under the Real ID. So we certainly would try to work very hard in terms of coming into compliance as soon as possible, but we really believe that we need to have realistic timelines. We need to have the ability to choose our own card design and ensure that we're meeting the needs of Minnesotans. And I think that I'm speaking the same type of speech that almost every motor vehicle administrator in the country is saying, because we believe very strongly in the 10th Amendment and our ability to work together as we have through that association for over 100 years. That association has been in place. And so I think that we would very much support it, but we feel we need some changes in order to be able to make it work.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. McCormick? Ms. McCormick, from your um, evaluation for the state, let's say draft regulations were finalized, say, by December. Practically speaking, when do you think Minnesota would be at the point where we could actually be able to even say we could start our process to be in compliance?
Madam Chair, I would say that we would need at least time to be able to have legislative changes that we think we may need. We'll need to see what the final regulations say, which may, or we may need to promulgate current identity and residency rules that we have in place, which, you know, so that would be about a year possibly. But in terms of our information system, we really would have to get that in place and do the reengineering as part of the plan. But to get that in place, we think would be at least at a minimum about a three-year process. That'd be at the minimum.
So, Ms. McCormick, what I'm hearing Mr. Meadows is that we get until 2013, and let's say we could ask for an extension based on our structural barriers, so we get that extension, but then assuming that it takes us at minimum 3 years, practically speaking, in the time remaining, we are now crunched. Do you think that it would be possible for us in that time to bring all our driver's license holders into compliant? We have 5 years, Mr. Meadows, starting in May?
That's correct. Starting May 11, 2008, there are 5 years to issue real ID compliant driver's licenses to all Minnesota residents.
So assuming that, say, it takes us 3 years, we have 2 years in that window to really come into compliant. Is it even doable, Ms. McCormick?
Madam Chair, we would need at least once we're starting to come into compliance, we would need 4 years because we're on a four-year renewal cycle. Otherwise, we'd have to be doubling up the drivers coming in ahead of time to get their driver's licenses. And so it would be difficult for us to do that. It could be done, but you'd be talking about many, many additional resources in order to bring that many more people into our stations and also have that identification documents that are required, at least under the current regulations. We're hoping for some changes with the final rules.
So. Ms. McCormick, under the background requirements, the background check requirements for the employees, has there been standards issued to disqualify certain employees? And, what is the intent of it? And will certain employees now be disqualified once they've gone through the background check?
Madam Chair, that's one of the concerns, is that they haven't issued standards and they haven't set any way to get some of the information, like this warrant information they talk about that we would need access to. They haven't put any they haven't really fleshed any of that out. It may be in these final rules. We certainly mentioned it in our comments that we didn't feel that there was enough information for us to proceed with that. So it's something that we would need to wait to see, but it's certainly in the current rules, the draft rules, it would be very difficult for us to comply because there isn't a standard in which that we'll know that we've complied with whatever their standard is at this point in time.
Okay. Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, either for Ms. McCormick or Mr. Meadows or both, does this federal law allow us to do optional compliance in the sense that people who wanted to get a real ID driver's license could get it, and we could, you know, maybe we could set up a dozen places throughout the state where they could go to get it. And people who don't care about flying on planes or going in federal buildings could just have the normal process, and then we could charge whatever the necessary fee was to those people who wanted it for the verification things, and avoid the need of setting up all these big systems. I mean, is that possible under the law, and is that feasible as a practical matter to set it up so that only the people who really needed a real ID compliant driver's license could get it?
Ms. McCormick?
I might defer to Mr. Meadows, but I'll give it my best shot. I think that the way we would have to first be approved by the Department of Homeland Security to be able to issue a real ID driver's license or ID card. And from what I gather, we'd have to have all this in place for them to issue it. And for us to even do that, especially with the online verification that's required. I mean, right now what we do is if we see something that looks fraudulent or doesn't appear to match with what we're doing, we call whatever that federal agency is or our state agency and find out. So we have a way where we can just suspend that issuing while we do those types of checks, and then we require the driver to come in and figure out and they have the last chance to give us more information, so we'll allow them to have a driver's license. But to do what they're suggesting here, I think we would have to still have it all in place, even if we only did it for certain people, and I still think we'd run into the fact that we wouldn't have the time to come into compliance with what the current deadline is in the law.
Senator Neville, follow up on that. Is it possible to do the verifications without all these interactive systems and softwares and things? I mean, and just have the people who want them pay the fee. If it's $100, if it's $200, I mean, how do you verify now? You just get on the phone and talk to people in other states or other. How is that done?
Ms. McCormick?
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, well, that's what we're doing right now. I think that I don't think DHS would approve it, though. I think what they're saying is it has to be this online verification system. I think most states that we've talked to, it's still going to be where we're going to have to let a lot of people know that they're going to have to come back while we check in further, because some of these systems may not give you definitive information currently that that is who they say they are. It may be something where we'll still have to do further investigation. But one thing that the Department of Homeland Security has said is that some of their systems, which aren't really able to take the volume at this point or may still need further upgrades themselves, that we would not be required to use those systems until they are really meeting the letter of the law. So it's very tenuous as to whether they'll meet the letter of the law by the time we're required to have it in place or not. Mm. But that's what they've said to us so far. So, I mean, that might be a step. They're talking about, there's been discussions at least about maybe phasing it in with certain groups, such as what you're saying, and that may be what they come back with in their final rules, but that's not what we're dealing with right now. So it's more or less we have to react to what we already have information on until we hear differently.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just was thinking along the same lines you were, I guess, with the question I was going to ask before, but just to follow up and follow a little further with that line of inquiry. As a legislature, we're going to be asked to invest a considerable amount of taxpayers' money into this if we were to go ahead with it. And whether it's even doable is a question we should be looking at before we decide to make that kind of an investment, I would think. And I'd be interested in, kind of laying out the timeline of what would need to happen in order to make this project work. I know, for example, with the Department of Human Services, they're trying to implement a new data information system, and it's taken already much longer. I can't remember. I haven't been here long, I guess, enough to know exactly, but I'm sure Senator Berglund could tell us, probably to the month, how overdue that implementation is at the present time. These things tend to always take longer than we think they're going to. And I would think that first you'd have to see what type of legislation we passed next session to really be able to know how to design that type of system. And so you wouldn't really even be able to start designing that software until we passed whatever legislation we were passing, at least not finalizing it. And then it would, the engineering of that software, as you said, would probably take at a minimum 3 years. I'm thinking that we're going to be passing a huge unfunded mandate onto local governments or onto these driver's license agencies to be able to, and they're not going to be able to know what systems they have until they know how your system is set up and working so that they can interact. I'm sure there are all kinds of technical difficulties that I'm not thinking of because I'm not really knowledgeable in that area. But then we're going to have to interact with all these other state systems. And if we all have different privacy standards and we all have different technology standards and we're trying to have our systems talk to each other, then that seems to me it adds another layer of complication on top of just what our designing and putting in place our system. And so, again, I guess I'm just kind of asking for a little bit more detail about our chairman's question. Is this something that we should be spending millions of dollars or potentially $1 billion of taxpayers' money on? Is it even possible?
Well, Senator Olson, I think that it's not Ms. McCormick's call to make the determination on whether or not we should be spending the money. I think she has the unfortunate task of just complying because it's the law. So we get to make that call. But I think that your point is well made. If Ms. McCormick, if you could kind of maybe draw a kind of a timetable for us along that line of sort of what would the practical timeline be for Minnesota in terms of compliance, I think that would help us lay out, you know, what kind of a timetable we're looking at. If you could do that, that would be helpful. I want to have our citizen participant come up and give us his comments, and then we could perhaps follow up with any other questions to all four of the testifiers. Mr. Nathan, please come up to the table. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Dale Nathan. I am here as a citizen advocate, and I want to assure you up front, Madam Chair, I'll be fairly brief, about 3 to 4 minutes at the most. I do want to express my gratitude to you, Senator Mua, and to your assistant, Ms. Regina Garza, for inviting me and for facilitating my appearance. Beginning in April of this year, I and some associates conducted a series of 32 town meetings around Minnesota on the Real ID Act. Our sense of it was that the citizens of Minnesota know nothing about the Real ID Act. As you heard today from Mr. Meadows, it was kind of slipped in as a last-minute addition to a federal appropriations act. So your citizens in Minnesota, what we found, know nothing about the Real ID Act, and frankly, they're shocked. So we decided to conduct these town meetings, and we did. On the second page of my outline, which I believe you've been provided a copy, is a list of the communities that we visited and at which we discussed the Real ID Act. And we're going to continue this town meeting series on other issues, such as the health care proposals before the legislature, et cetera. We had an average attendance of about 20 people at 24 of our meetings, and we had a total attendance of over 460 people at these town meetings. At these town meetings, we showed an excerpt from an excellent movie, at least in my opinion, that discusses the Real ID Act and other subjects, but the Real ID Act at length. Now, that movie is one that was produced by Aaron Russo, a Hollywood producer. It is entitled America, From Freedom to Fascism. It is about the Real ID Act and also about how Americans are losing so many of their freedoms. I gave a copy of that movie, the full-length version, to Ms. Garza. She has it. She also has a 12-minute excerpt, and that excerpt is on the Real ID Act, and I highly commend that 12-minute excerpt. It will give you more understanding of the Real ID Act than I possibly could in a much longer period of time. With or at our town meetings, we distributed postcards, and we distributed address labels addressed to you, the people's representatives and senators. We gave them an information sheet with your emails, your mail addresses, your telephone numbers, and we gave them a sample letter to the editors, all this in an attempt to get citizens to express their views to you. What did we find? Of the 460 attendees, 460 plus, very few had ever heard of the Real ID Act. They were grateful for the opportunity to get some information about it. Only one person that I can recall spoke in favor of the Real ID Act. The overwhelming number of people said, no, we do not want the Real ID Act in Minnesota. And frankly, there was anger that on the part of many that this legislation slipped through with no public debate, with very little, if anything, in the media or the newspapers. It was a shock to most of these people. Many compared what they heard with a part of the book of Revelation in the New Testament, which is called or referred to commonly as the Mark of the Beast. And that's because the heart of the Real ID Act is the RFID chip. And that's a part, or will be a part, of the driver's license and the like, is my understanding. The RFID chip, which is discussed in this movie and in the excerpt, is a very tiny device, about a quarter of an inch long in most cases, that has a transmitter and an antenna. And the idea is that each of you, each of us, will have our own electronic identification incorporated in that RFID chip, which in turn would be incorporated in your identification card. You will need that RFID chip, as it's said, to go into federal buildings, to buy things, for transactions at the bank. In short, you will be electronically tagged. Of perhaps greatest concern, and the movie brings this out, is the implantable RFID chip, and there's open talk of that. That is actually a device about the size of a grain of rice that literally is implanted in your body. And there is speculation that we are moving toward that kind of a identification system. The genesis of the Real ID Act and the RFID chip is probably in a project going back to 1999, when MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Procter Gamble, and the Gillette Company developed the RFID chip to mark their products. Many of the products that people buy today are tagged with an RFID chip, and the purpose is marketing, to identify purchasers and the like. And the real threat may not be a government database, but a commercial database that accumulates all the data of the transactions, of where you go, where you travel, what you read, because that's part of the thought, your physical characteristics, that'll be a part of this system. And that, in turn, feeds two purposes. Number one is marketing, to get that data to market. And number two, which is much more sinister if you accept this, and that's control. And the film speaks openly that this entire RFID, Real ID Act effort is part of a system, or at least proposal, to control the world population. Now, again, I recommend that you visit two sources of authority. Number one would be this film that I talked about, at least the 12-minute excerpt. And there's a book by Catherine Albrecht, and that book is entitled Spy Chips. And it is a book about the movement toward control of the world's population. We do plan to continue our series of town meetings, assuming we can get the funding for it. We think that we serve a useful purpose in going to our cities, municipalities, and informing them about the Real ID Act, helping them to express their thoughts to you, especially since next year it may be that the House would be considering Senate 984, which, as you know, was passed by the Senate and is now awaiting action, hopefully, in the Minnesota House of Representatives. Our particular organization, we're not a formal organization. We don't do any advocating. We don't have any causes. We simply inform people. But we think that an informed population would serve to let you know what they want and help you decide as a matter of policy if Minnesota should join the five or more states that have rejected the Real ID Act, or if, as Madam Chair has said, we should be working to implement it. Perhaps we might want to consider asking our federal legislators to repeal the Real ID Act, and have in mind the references that Mr. Meadows had. That concludes my prepared remarks. Thank you very, very much.
Mr. Nathan, thank you for your time. Any questions for any of the witnesses? We have about 10 minutes left. Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, I have one more kind of technical question. I have a passport, and I perhaps should know the answer to this, but what does it take to get a federal passport today in terms of identification information? And does Real ID ask for more verification than is necessary to get a passport today?
Mr. Meadows.
Madam Chair, the answer is yes. Real ID requires more authentication of identity than is necessary to obtain a U.S. passport.
What does it take to get a passport? Does anybody know?
Birth certificate, and I believe birth certificate and demonstration of Social Security number, I believe.
And do they do verification? My recollection is that I went to my courthouse. I gave them the documents. They had to keep the originals and send them in, and then they send them back to you afterwards. But does somebody do a verification at the federal level then that they're asking us to do at the state level?
I can't speak definitively, but I assume that they do. Okay. And I know that you can process a passport even at a post office. So there are many outlets.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, the reason I asked is if a passport works as well as a real ID, it seems a little ludicrous that we're going to be jumping through so many more hoops at the driver's license stage than it takes to get a passport, and we should just tell our citizens, go get a passport. And I heard that message last week in Boston too, when I was at the NCSL convention.
Any other questions for our witnesses? Representative Mullery.
If there's any more questions for Mr. Meadows or involving him, I'll wait till the end because he isn't going to be around. No more?
No more.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Engler, I had two questions almost the same. Well, before we get to that, I want to thank you for reminding me of one of the great all-time cult movies, Harold and Maude, even better than the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And you mentioned the problems with other states being more lenient on allowing information and within our state different standards by agency and counties. My first question is, I've never run in, and obviously you run into it all the time. In fact, you get my questions, and Don Gimberling before you got a lot of my questions. But I had never run into an agency or a local government that wasn't more strict than we were. Is there a lot the other way? And then the second question is, with regard to other states, is there any way we could automatically redact things that we didn't want out?
Ms. Engler?
Madam Chair, Representative Mulray, what I was trying to talk about inconsistency across units of government, is the fact that right now, in order to declare something what we call security information under the Data Practices Act, the responsible authority in each unit of government has to make that declaration for the data, which means that while Commissioner Campion could declare the security plan for public safety security information, he doesn't control how the data would be classified in any one of the counties or any of the, necessarily any other local unit as far as making the declaration about those security plans. And so if one county responsible authority failed to declare the information as security information, then we have a gap in the protection, which is why I presented the issue to you that you should at least consider classifying those security plans so they're the declaration of that protection is not dependent on individual actions by the different levels of government. And you asked me about whether or not we could redact information before we shared it with other states. I think in looking at the proposed federal regulations, the issue is for Minnesota to be able to verify information maintained in other states and for the states to do the opposite. And so the whole purpose of the data exchange is to be able to verify the different documents and data that have been presented in support of the Real ID compliant driver's license or identification card. And so I think redacting data elements is going to be counter to the purpose of doing the verification and would make it more difficult for people now in Minnesota necessarily to get the data they need from another state or from people who are now in another state getting Minnesota information in order for them to get one of these Real ID compliant driver's licenses. So I don't think it's this concern about sharing the data among the different state government agencies. It's the issue that the security then becomes as strong as the weakest link in the system. And we can control Minnesota, but we can't control the other 49 states. And just as we can control how we treat the data in Minnesota, we can't control how it's treated in the other 49 states. So unfortunately, the failure of the Real ID legislation itself, at least according to the Department of Homeland Security, to provide any uniformity of treatment across the states on these issues leaves us with the potential for a patchwork that, if you live your life in your retirement in Minnesota and you don't need to go outside the state to get your compliant driver's license, you're probably fine. But once you go to another state and you want a driver's license, a compliant driver's license issued in that other state, you now have different issues because you're now dependent on that other state's law to protect the data that they're collecting on you.
Ms. McCormick, if we're looking at the system, I would Ms. Engler's comment just reminded me that if we were getting inquiries from other states into our database, I would assume that you all would have some concerns about authenticating to make sure whoever's making the inquiry was an appropriate person making that inquiry, as opposed to who else out there has access to the system who could be hacking it or in the system making inappropriate inquiries. I'm assuming that those are things that you are contemplating in this design of the system.
Madam Chair, yes. I think the one thing that AMVA has been very strong on is the fact that we believe that we need this driver system, and I think that Mr. Meadows talked a little bit about, which means it's a pointer system, so that you have to go through this connection at the, you know, through AMVA, but then every state has to, we all have to have similar standards in terms of who we would allow to point, who would be allowed to have their request be pointed at our state's data. And AMVA has written a lengthy letter to that effect to the Department of Homeland Security, and I could make copies and get that to your office so that you could share it with the members, because I think that's a very much a concern of Minnesota, you know, as well as other jurisdictions. I did want to at least mention, though, because I was a little concerned that I want to make sure that the members understand that the department does really take data security very seriously, and through Chapter 13, any of our agents or any stakeholders that work on our behalf or need our data in order to do their transactions that we have relationship with, we have individual agreements with those individuals. Everyone is given a unique password, and they can only access the data that is required for their use. So that would be our deputy registrar staff, our DL agent staff, the dealer staff that have to work to access motor vehicle information, the courts, prosecuting attorneys. They're given individual passwords so that we can go back and audit that information to ensure that they are using that information the way that it's determined to be used according to Chapter 13. So we are working at that, and we do make sure that our agents are following our procedures in terms of data practices.
Very good. Any other questions for the testifiers? Mr. Nathan, Ms. McCormick, Ms. Engler, Mr. Meadows, thank you very much for your time and for your information. The committee greatly appreciates it. We will make this information available to any other members of the legislature who are interested. Thank you. Oh, Ms. Meadows, did you have a comment you wanted to make to close us out?
Yes, Madam Chair, if I may. I would like to make just a couple closing comments. One is to state that neither the Real ID Act as legislation nor the draft regulations currently issued by the Department of Homeland Security specifically call for an RFID chip. Now, the prospect is possibly there. We don't know what's in the final regulations, but nothing currently on the books anticipates an RFID per requirement for the states to put those in driver's licenses. I also wanted to note in response to one of Senator Limmer's prior comments that there are efforts afoot, as I noted in my comments about congressional activity, to fix and fund or make other changes to Real ID. And at the National Conference of State Legislatures, we always say that our best lobbyists are you, our members. And so I would just leave you with a final encouragement to be in touch with your senators, to be in touch with your congressmen, to make them aware of any concerns, support issues, any ideas that you may have about Real ID as it is progressing through this regulatory process, and any congressional authorization changes or appropriations. Because hearing from you will be one of the most important things for your representation in Washington to hear and to know as they're making these decisions.
Okay.
But thank you for this opportunity.
Sure. Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, Mr. Meadows, while you're here, have you heard of any information of whether or not new issue or a new generation of passports that's now in the design works to have a chip of some sort in it? Is that... Have you heard of anything? I've heard that, but I don't know if that's true or not.
Mr. Meadows?
Thank you, Madam Chair. There is some discussion. I don't know that there's the requirement in place that new passports have such a chip, but I can certainly check. and get back to you.
All right.
Thank you. And members, thank you for making the time to be here. I know that it is the middle of the summer, but this is just such an important area that, again, has not received a lot of time and attention, and I just felt like we, particularly the Judiciary Committee and the Senate and the Data Practices Group, we just had to give it a really good overview and give it some thought over the summer. So I want to personally thank all of you for making the time to be here. And Representative Mullery, thank you for sending out the notice to your members and for also bringing the House.
And Madam Chair, thank you for putting this on, and we'll get those recalcitrant members in the House to get some of this info.
Yeah. Thank you. The committee is adjourned.
Can we take this, or is this? Can we take this?
You